Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The Swarbricks team are Bitcoiners, and they are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand, as well as general legal advice. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with Rob Clarkson about scaling Bitcoin's Layer 2 Lightning Protocol and how changes happen to Bitcoin more generally. Rob provides a technical introduction to some of the proposals, such as L2, APO, CTV, and we talk a bit about what covenants and vaults mean in Bitcoin. Now, I'm still trying to work a lot of this out for myself, and Rob does really well to break it down and explain it to me. And even though these are quite advanced topics, I think it is important to have the discussion and work together to understand what proposed changes to Bitcoin might mean and what the dangers and opportunities are. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show.
Yeah, I listened to your podcast with Darcy, and I kind of got that impression that you were like, you're kind of like, shit's fucking broken, man.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was disagreeing. I'm like, it's things are pretty messed up.
I think if I was 10 years older, it would be a different story. But it's like the classic millennial story, you know, like I was born into the darkness of, you know, all of this stuff, and like finished high school and straight into GFC, and you know, like I've never known the good times, even though I think there have been good times. And you know, all of the people my age are just sort of in the same boat, whereas there's like, I think people a little bit older were able to just sort of slip in, but ultimately it's not a major, it's just part of the journey. But
I think, I mean, Bitcoin gives me hope, and without Bitcoin, I don't know how much hope I'd have, and I don't know how much better I'd be doing. I probably wouldn't be doing very good myself if I hadn't discovered Bitcoin. So,
yeah,
it's definitely, yeah. Not everybody can just discover Bitcoin, though, you know, and that's the problem, is we all want to help people discover Bitcoin, but people are open to discovering Bitcoin. So it's like, it's kind of, catch 22.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is certainly, a very important project, and it's helped me navigate a lot of this stuff. It's given me I feel a lot of responsibility to take it on. You know, not everyone can see what I see, and I hopefully today we're going to cover some of the technical, which certainly is something that I'm not so good at seeing myself, but kind of how it fits together politically, socially is something that really just makes sense to me, but it's actually quite hard to explain. It's in a way, it's kind of like a hash, you know, like it's easy to verify once you've got the answer, but it actually takes a lot of work to get to the answer. I don't know if that'd be a hash or an encryption, but it would be an encryption, yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah,
it'd be both. Well, I mean, they're very similar in the way they work. They're one-way functions, right?
So one-way function, so it's like, and then like, you talk to someone who doesn't know anything about it, and it's like, oh man, I got to go and run the whole thing again and like go through the whole conversation. But I have a shorthand for getting to that answer that, yeah, this certainly provides a new direction and a new hope, you know, very, very optimistic for Bitcoin and for societies that adopt Bitcoin. I think there's, that's exciting. I don't know how else to put it. But Rob, today you know, we were chatting offline, and you know, this show I talk a lot about some of the softer stuff around the philosophy, the economics, the culture of Bitcoin, but first and foremost, it is a technology, and there's been a few things happen in the last couple of months, different proposed upgrades and kind of conversations around the future of the technology, and I thought it would be good to catch up with you and maybe talk through those and kind of what they mean and how they connect together, and ultimately how the technology of Bitcoin changes and can be changed over time. And I know you've got some technical expertise in this area. So yeah, I thought maybe I could hand it over to you. I've got your notes here that you sent through to me earlier, and I've just been going through those. But I guess where do you want to start talking about the technical aspects of Bitcoin as it stands today?
Yeah, I'd just like to start by just pinning my level, although I am a technical guy, understanding these technical changes to Bitcoin to a very deep level is definitely not something that I'm able to do in its entirety. And in actual fact, it sounds like, having listened to a few other people talking about them, that even the different communities who are working on different proposals don't agree on the interpretation of the proposals between themselves. So I think what's cool is that, well, the thing about Bitcoin is we all have to come to consensus, right? And we can't all be entirely on the lowest level of the technical sort of understanding. So what I've attempted to do here, as best I can, is to interpret the technical stuff about these proposals as best I can, and then to attempt to explain them in less technical terms. And unfortunately, you can't always go super high level because, there are technical things, and so we might maybe lose some people along some way with some of the stuff, but hopefully the gist is what we can get across. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
They're all pretty interlinked, but I looked at, you mentioned looking into L2, and it's one that I've heard about a few times, and so I did find it quite interesting. And it's proposed by some pretty good players in the Lightning development space, such as Rusty Russell and a couple of other authors whose names escaped me just now. L2. So Lightning is great. It's awesome. We can pay each other instantly. We can accept payments instantly. It's working. There are niggles to it, the way it's been implemented. One of the niggles is that when you back up your node, you back up your channels, you make a backup of them, because if anything were to happen to your node, it was to break, you'd need to recover your channels to the state they were at. And the state changes all the time depending on payments flowing through your channels. So what can happen is, if you, the payment across a channel can change depending on how much money's been spent across it. And so how much of the funds are on your side of the channel and how much of the funds are on the other side of the channel varies depending on how, you know, that each payment that goes through the channel changes that state. So the node has to keep a copy of that state to recover from should there be any problems. Now, one way I can cheat you is if we have a channel together and I have one Bitcoin on my side and you have zero Bitcoins on your side, then a few payments go across so that I have, say, half a Bitcoin on my side, now half a Bitcoin on your side. I could try and cheat you by trying to broadcast an older transaction from the channel where I still have one Bitcoin on my side of the channel, right? Does that make sense? And so Lightning has a penalty transaction that prevents this cheating by basically giving the person who's being the potential victim of the cheating the entire funds of the channel should this cheating attempt to take place. Now, that's great and prevents cheating. And so nobody's cheating on the Lightning network because of this. But the downside is, if I try to recover my channel state and I broadcast it, in the process of recovering that channel state, broadcast an older transaction by accident, what happens then is I've done what looks to the network like cheating, and then your node would automatically broadcast the penalty transaction and you'd receive the full funds of the channel, despite my actual intentions not being to cheat you out of the funds, just to be to attempt to recover my Lightning node channels. Have I still got you?
Yeah, I've got a question about that. So
okay,
if you've got a high volume Bitcoin Lightning node and it's one or two transactions behind, or there's maybe some latency in there, would that have, and then that channel needs to get broadcast, you know, that channel wants to get closed, and you think you're closing it, you're just wanting to wrap it up and finish with it. But is there a situation somewhere in there where that could be seen as an illegitimate transaction that needs to be punished, where it's somehow not quite up to date, or there's some sort of caching issue. I'm not sure. Like, is there anything in that space that could cause issues for people?
Absolutely. Yeah, if the closing node was to broadcast an older state of the transaction, that would look like an attempted steal of the funds.
Is there any way, sorry, is there any way to almost stop updating the state? So you decide at a certain point, nothing else is going to change, but then you can wait before and kind of freeze it before you decide to go on chain and close it.
Yes, your node will do that. So if you're attempting to close the channel, your node would, as my understanding is, it would stop processing transactions at that point and then say to the other node, what you'd normally get is a cooperative close, assuming both nodes on both sides of the channel are online. One node says to the other, I'd like to close this channel. Here's my closing transaction. The other node goes, okay, sad about this, but let's close it. And then signs the transaction, you have essentially a cooperative close, and then that channel is done with, and there's no chance of stealing from it.
So that's the two of two multi-sig transaction there. So
Exactly.
in that case, yeah, I guess that's getting to sort of the technical there, but like if in a cooperative case, those both states on both sides will be up to date.
Yes.
But what does a uncooperative close look like? How do you go about doing that if you were to do that?
Yeah, that's right. So if you want to close the channel and the other side of the channel is not responding for any reason or refusing to respond, you have to do what's called a force close, which is basically a sort of a pre-signed transaction. You force close with the latest state of the channel, which you have. And then this is where the cheating could potentially come in, because if I don't broadcast the latest state of the channel and there's a later state, that is where the penalty transaction could come into play. So let's imagine I managed to knock out the power to your node, so you're temporarily offline, and I go, okay, I'm going to broadcast my force closing payment, but with an earlier channel state where I have more of the funds on my side. If you're not able to get back online in time before the duration of the timeout of that force close, before it confirms, then I've essentially stolen from you. And we have a solution for this already called watchtowers. So what happens is the watchtower receives a, you send the watchtower your latest copy of the state. And then if the watchtower sees you go offline and then a force close happen, and it notices that the force close is not with the latest state, it will broadcast the penalty transaction on your behalf. So we sort of already have mitigations for this kind of scenario that I've kind of described here.
Okay, and just oh, sorry,
Yeah, sorry. No, go
no,
on.
and let's go. And sorry, I know this is sort of some lightning fundamental stuff here, but where does that 2 week window come in for? Is that for a forced close? You've got 2 weeks to come back on the other side with the correct latest state, which would override the other person's fraudulent transaction.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be 2 weeks.
Or
It's just a
within.
period of time, yeah, that's negotiated between the
Okay.
two
Yep.
nodes at the point at which the channel is set up,
So you can do a custom
is my
time on
understanding.
that. Okay.
So
Interesting.
what's the problem with this? Well, the problem that L2 has identified is that, yeah, if you're trying to recover your node and you accidentally broadcast an older state, you've done what looks like an attack on the other node, and so the penalty transaction is fired, and then you've lost all the funds. And so it's not ideal. That's really bad. And the other problem is that what you actually have to do is store a copy of every state change in the duration of the Lightning channel. For the duration of the Lightning channel, every state has to be kept. And that, actually listening to a podcast with Matt Corallo, isn't actually such a big deal, because the state changes are not that large, and we have quite sufficient large disks that we can attach to it. So it's actually, thirdly, the fact that we can now splice. So when you splice into a channel, I should explain what splicing is, I suppose. So That allows you to increase the size of a channel or reduce the size of the channel on the fly while the channel is still sort of being in use. So typically what you had to do before splicing was available was you had to, if you wanted to increase the size of a channel, you'd actually have to close the channel and reopen a bigger channel. So splicing allows you to sort of, it'd be sort of the equivalent of your airplane is the channel, and while the airplane's flying, another airplane comes along and adds more cargo to the airplane while it's in flight. Would be one analogy to use to describe it. So when that happens, you don't need to, you can get rid of all the older state at the point at which you splice. So it's actually not such a big deal as it could be. But L2 is proposing this because what can actually happen is with L2, you can broadcast a state of a channel on the main chain at any point. And it doesn't matter if that's an older state, because a newer state can always be broadcast after that, and it doesn't cause a penalty transaction, so all the funds aren't taken. So basically, this is pretty cool, because we don't have to be so worried about this sort of like stealing scenario that can happen, and there's potentially other benefits of L2 as well.
Just quickly on that note, so state changes. That's simply updating the balance on the channel between the two parties, right? So that every time a transaction is routed through that channel, that's going to change that state. I mean, what sort of volume and size does that add up to for an economic node that's actually running quite a bit of stuff through it?
Yeah, it would be a fair amount for a large node, but I couldn't actually give you any figures. I don't know. It's not something that I've had to worry about with my node, but then again, my node is not a massively economic node. So
yeah. And it would be different for each channel you have open. So if you've got a node that, you know, you've got a node that's got, you know, 100 channels to different people, different other nodes open, that single node is going to maybe, you know, have a quite a lot of state changes that it has to store. And you're saying splicing, though, wipes out and kind of resets that state, so you don't have to store it.
Yes, I wasn't aware of this, but I listened to a podcast with Matt Corallo, and he said this is what splicing does. It basically resets the state. You can throw away all the old state at the point in which you splice in or out. So
yeah, well, I guess the splice is on-chain, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that sort of would reset it from there. Interesting. Okay, so L2, though, you've got some notes here around how it helps. It allows you to show that on chain, and then a state at a certain point, and then at a later date you can have a more recent state on a more recent block on higher up.
So the other benefit that I forgot to mention was that, so in a high fee environment, For your pre-signed transaction on the Lightning Network, you've had to assign a fee rate already to them. And so this can cause, there can be additional problems in the fact that these sort of force closes and penalty transactions and stuff in a high fee environment might not be confirmed in time or at all. And so another benefit of L2 is that if you broadcast your state, you can choose at any point you can do that, broadcast the current state of the channel. And then you've kind of locked it in, and you've done that at a point at which the fee rate is at a point at which you can decide. So you can say, okay, at this stage, at this state, I'm going to lock this fee rate in. And then I could lock in an older fee rate onto the on-chain. That doesn't matter. It can just be updated by either of us, either side of the node at any, either side of the channel by either node at any stage by just broadcasting a newer version of the state. And there's no penalty involved in that. And so, yeah, it allows you to sort of like lock the state in place at a point, a particular time, which the fee rate is at which you're happy with, essentially.
So I'm still, sorry, a little bit newbie here, but I'm trying to understand here, that broadcast of the state, is that single-sided or collaborative broadcasting? So who would broadcast the state to the on-chain?
Either side of the channel.
So one or the other. Yep. And in what situation, so assuming we had L2 was possible, what would be a situation where you would be doing that?
It would be potentially just to confirm the state on chain. I guess it reduces your potential exposure or your potential risk. So at any state in the duration of a current Lightning channel, you're at risk of your node being unavailable and or down, and a forced close transaction broadcasting an older state at any stage. And so being able to lock a state in essentially reduces the risk of you losing any funds in the channel to that amount
point. You could imagine there might be tooling in the future that would allow you, say, when a state reaches a certain threshold, or after, you know, every 3 months or every week, you know, larger economic nodes that this would be really important for, they could maybe just have an automatic state update that gets broadcast, and maybe if the fees are higher than a certain amount, they skip it or something. But you could see that being more of a, instead of all or nothing, you know, since the beginning of the Lightning channel through to its closure, there's nothing on chain. It actually becomes, you've got these sort of incremental auto saves. Is that sort of?
Yeah, that sounds like a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then if there was, so you say you update the state on chain, and then after that there is a forced close. What would happen then?
The channel can continue until it is actually closed. It's just literally the current state of the channel has been locked in place by being broadcast online until a newer state is then broadcast as well.
Okay.
So, So, like I say, this is my limited understanding in a layman's terms of how L2 works. So I guess if you're looking to dig into that any deeper, you should probably check out the L2 paper, which is online. And I guess we could put a link. I was just going to say, I'm also planning to write this into an article for the Kiwi Bitcoin Guide as well. So if anybody's interested or got any, you know, wants to have something to read, they can check it out on there later on.
Yeah, no, thank you. So I guess we're both trying to, you know, lead each other through this area, but it seems like there is issues where the current way Lightning operates, it can be dangerous, and you can fat finger a forced close you can fat finger an on-chain transaction that could be seen as a forced close that is fraudulent, and which would make you lose the funds in these punishment transactions where you lose everything on that channel, right? Goes to the other party.
Exactly. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
And that's like, you know, got to be very careful. And if you're trying to develop stuff, because, you know, that's not really a major issue if you're running stock software, you're running your own, you know, Umbral node or something, but it'd be issues if you're actually trying to develop that stuff and you're trying to test it out and, you know, you think you've got it right and then something happens. So it's maybe a little bit stifling for innovation because there isn't those save points or those sort of safeguards in place. It's sort of, you really have to be confident that you've coded it perfectly. So would you say that's a way of categorizing that?
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair assumption. I think there can be, if you run a major economic node and you have some kind of hardware malfunction whereby the state is being updated and for whatever reason is not being saved to your disk, that would be significantly bad because you could lose a large amount of funds through that. So this would be like I said, I think it's a good way of minimizing the risk of having those funds in flight, as it were.
Yeah, and I wonder if, I mean, I'm not sure what average channel size is or anything, but like, I mean, there'd be, you know, tens of Bitcoin at stake potentially on even a single channel. I don't know what the biggest channels are like, but it could be actually like you make one mistake and that's all gone. And so that risk, you know, if you're looking at it from a business point of view, like what risk am I going to take running an economic node? You know, there's not, you know, major benefits or, you know, you can make money off it, but it's, if the risk is, you know, a single Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoin for, you know, some hardware malfunction, that could be stifling. So it seems like this would be helpful for that. But to actually get L2, which also is known as alien symmetry, right? There's some upgrades that are required for the Bitcoin network. So can we talk a little bit about what those are?
Yeah, that's right. But by my understanding, the L2 developers have proposed an upgrade known as APO or any previous output. And so what that does is it, well, I mean, essentially it's the sort of the minimum upgrade that we could do to enable L2. And so that's, I should specify, it's L2 spelled E-L-T-O-O. It's because when I went looking for it, I was like, oh, this is, but yeah, you'd have to know how it's spelled anyway. But yeah, so they basically said, here's a small upgrade we need to enable L2. But that upgrade that they proposed is something that can be used to do what's known as covenants on Bitcoin. Covenants was way back in the day by Greg Maxwell, was warned about by Greg Maxwell on the Bitcoin Talk forum. He kind of said, hey, you got, you know, why would you want somebody to be constraining transactions, sort of alluding to potential government interference, or not even government, but just sort of, I guess, centralized interference. So the question is then, so if we're going to enable L2, sorry, add APO to enable L2, and APO allows covenants, but it allows covenants in a kind of a hacky, not very efficient way. Should we maybe do a more efficient and nicer upgrade to Bitcoin to enable covenants, which would also enable L2, but with a different way of doing covenants known as CTV or check template verify, or any of the other covenant proposals as well? But I've got to say that APO and CTV are the only sort of two I've really looked into for this.
Yep. And just coming back to covenants, like what does that mean at its most basic level?
Yeah, so, well, to look at covenants from a sort of a broader perspective, covenants are known for when you buy like land or a house, and they normally say things like you can only paint your walls this color, or your roof this color, or what kind of plants you can plant. And it's sort of similar in Bitcoin. So covenants is a way of basically saying what you can do on future transactions by setting rules on a sort of a prior parent transaction. So you can basically, what's known as encumber a future transaction with certain rules based on the rules that you set on the transaction.
So what sort of rules could those be?
Yeah, so it could be things like you could allow spending to only a certain address or number of addresses. So you could say any future transactions from these can only be spent to this address or this address under certain conditions. And so what that then allows for is sort of us to create more interesting contracts out of these transactions to enable further use cases on Bitcoin.
Okay, so I mean, that one I've read about in a little bit around, you know, only being able to send to a certain address. So you've got a, oh, I mean, you could probably explain it better than me, but, you know, it can provide some safety around, say, cold storage funds and where they can be spent to. So maybe with that particular example, if you could give illustrate that a little bit, please.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We so covenants allow for sort of an opcode known as opvault, which would allow you to say lock some Bitcoin into a transaction that has a covenant on it, such that if funds come out of that transaction to any address that wasn't previously whitelisted in that transaction, then there is a certain time period by which you can broadcast a new transaction that reverses that transaction. So what that means is, yeah, you could put your super secure cold storage Bitcoin into this transaction, and then you could say to, you could, yeah, so if somebody comes and tries to steal your Bitcoin from that transaction, they would send it to their own transaction, but then you would have a certain period of time by which you could then broadcast another transaction, which would redirect the funds back to one of your whitelisted addresses.
So the time limit, would that be an optional thing here, or could you have just this can only ever be spent to these whitelisted addresses?
If you were going to have a transaction that can only spend to a singular address, you can do that at the moment. You would have just an unbroadcasted address, an unbroadcasted transaction already spending the funds to a single address. But the time limit is important because you might actually want to withdraw some of those funds out to another address yourself. And so what you would do is you would unvault those funds, is what this transaction would do to your address, that you would then be able to spend it to an address that you wanted to. So there's two scenarios where the funds leave the vault. Sorry, where the funds leave the vault. One would be that you would be yourself wanting to send some of those funds somewhere else, or it would be an attacker trying to send those funds somewhere else, and basically introduces this time period by which, if you disagreed with that unvaulting, you could broadcast this other transaction that would basically reverse the prior transaction when it got confirmed.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, just trying to get my head around that. So, because we can already do transactions that happen in the future, right? You can target a block. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So, that's one thing. You can already, as you say, have an unbroadcast transaction that's pre-signed that can be sitting there ready to trigger. And, you know, maybe say your private keys get stolen, you know, maybe if you're quick enough, you could get your transaction broadcast before the attacker steals your Bitcoin if you know about it. But you probably,
exactly,
you might not know about it until you see the transaction move on chain.
Yeah.
And so,
but
if you're
also the attacker could bribe a miner so that attacking transaction never appears in the mempool and just goes straight into a block, at which point you can't double spend it, if that makes sense. So
yeah. So yeah. With the vault situation, how would that play out? You're sitting there, your Bitcoin's been stolen, but you don't know about it. You see would you see something happen, get mined into a block? Or?
Well, I mean, assuming you're not under duress, or you're not out of signal, or you're not out of power, you would know by looking at your wallet that the funds had left the vault, because the transaction would be the unvaulting transaction would have been broadcast. But the vault transaction allows you to override where the funds have been sent for that period that you've preset, whether it's 2 weeks or, you know, however long, to give yourself enough time so that when you do come back online, you can then broadcast the transaction that undoes that first transaction.
And is this related to what we were talking about before with the L2 and those states that get broadcast on chain, where is all connected, but is that where you would be able to update the state?
Exactly. Sort of, yeah, okay. That would be it. Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, the benefit of this is it allows your security to be reactive. So at the moment, obviously all we have at the moment is preemptive security, or I'm not sure the right term for that, but you know, you do your best to keep your Bitcoin as secure as you can. You stamp your seed words into steel, you have a multi-sig, you keep them geographically dispersed. But as soon as somebody gets through all those layers of security, you're done for, and then your only options are sort of fiat world, sort of go to the police or engage a chain analysis company, or, you know, get a private detective to try and track your Bitcoin down and then somehow use the legal system as a recourse. Whereas this is actually would be an on-protocol reactive security. So, it just gives you that time frame by which you can reverse a transaction that you didn't intend to do. And so, yeah, I was sort of explaining it to a friend, and he said, well, hang on, I don't like the idea of being able to reverse transactions, Rob. It kind of defeats the whole purpose of Bitcoin, of transactions being final. And so that's a common misconception, because when you receive a Bitcoin, you give your Bitcoin address, you've already sort of, you generate that address yourself. And so if you generate an address that doesn't have covenants on it and somebody sends you Bitcoin, the Bitcoin can't be covenanted to your own address. There is no covenant on it. So whoever, you could receive a Bitcoin that has covenants on it, but you would have had to agree to those terms of the covenant to receive that Bitcoin anyway. So it's not in any problem or any way a problem on the finality of Bitcoin transactions. It would just allow you this extra use case for a certain type of transaction that you can create.
So that cold storage transaction that's just sitting there, that has the covenants attached to that particular transaction. And then if you were to send it, and maybe it's you know, that it's actually you who's wanting to send it, so it's a 2 week period that you've set, and you're actually wanting to send that yourself, you know, there's no fraud involved, it would just be a case of waiting until that period of time has elapsed, and then that would then be spendable again. It would actually end up in the address that you've whitelisted, and it would then be spendable from there. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So in that two, during that 2 week period, you'll see that it's going to resolve, or you know, however many blocks into the future, it will resolve and then be available. So would you expect, say, as soon as that block elapses, the vault lock period has elapsed, as soon as that happens, it would appear in that whitelisted wallet? Is that how it would work? Or
yeah, I mean, so how it would actually look in wallets is up to the wallet designers, because obviously they'd have to come up with the user, the sort of the UX and the UI to make it understandable to people what's happening. But yeah, you would know that there'd be a timeout on any transaction sent with covenants attached, because you would have created a covenant, so you would know it. And then for you to then on send that Bitcoin to somebody else uncovenanted, you'd have to just wait for that timeout period essentially.
Oh, so sorry. Yeah. So a whitelisted address, it would be instant, right?
That's a good question. I'm not actually sure about that, about how instant it would be going to your whitelisted address. I guess it would have to be instant, otherwise you wouldn't be able to recover your Bitcoin, but it could potentially be. I mean, the thing about covenants is it would allow you to concoct different kinds of covenanted transactions. It would allow you to sort of join different rules together. So you could add as many kind of different rules as you want as are allowed in the instruction set for a transaction, if that makes sense. So, you know, how it would work exactly would be up to the person, the wallet designer, or the person creating the transaction as such.
We're scratching the limits here of my reasoning, but so we've got a whitelisted address that will just go straight through. It gets processed and then it's available. But any address that's not whitelisted, there's a timeout period, and I wonder if that timeout period is something that's knowable on chain. I imagine it is, and it's encoded into the transaction, so you can see, you know, this will be spendable in, you know, 199 blocks. Do you think that's that you would know that if you were the recipient, right?
Yes, if you were the recipient, you would have known and agreed to it. But whether it's knowable by somebody who wasn't involved in the creation of that transaction, it's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. We're definitely touching the limits of my knowledge of how this works now.
It's all good, but look, the big idea is that there is these things called covenants, and there's a couple of different options available. Originally, APO was talked about to enable L2. Are you aware of what the differences are between APO and CTV?
I can tell you I haven't been able to look at the code at that low level, but I have heard, I listened to one of the panels from Bitcoin Miami, where a guy there said that CTV is the simplest form of covenants that we can program. So essentially, if Bitcoin is, he made a good point, if Bitcoin's going to have covenants, this is as simple as it can be. And my understanding is they're also non-recursive, which is potentially one of the attack vectors where some of the developers, like I say, not all, some are not worried about this, but some are worried about a recursive covenant being able to create sort of a loop on a Bitcoin network in terms of the verification, which could potentially be used as an attack against Bitcoin itself. Because if you slow down verification, you sort of knock some nodes offline because they can't kind of keep up with the sync fast enough. So we've kind of, you know, for obvious reasons, we've stayed away from loops on Bitcoin transactions. But so my understanding is CTV is a non-recursive covenant proposal that is the simplest way we can do covenants on Bitcoin. And so, you know, if we're, you might argue against quite a convoluted and clever and quite powerful covenant, but the problem with having all that extra power and functionality is you have additional attack vectors, whereas this one is the simplest version that we can do with the least amount known of attack vectors. So it's like upgrading Bitcoin with covenants in the most conservative way potentially that we can do it, is my understanding.
Yeah, and I think this conversation, and you and I as Bitcoiners, but I mean, certainly on my end, I'm struggling a little bit with the technical, you know, just even conceptualizing it, and then to even start thinking about what the trade-offs or the attack vectors are. I mean, that's some deep stuff right there. I mean, this opens up a bigger question about how Bitcoin has changed, how Bitcoin is updated, how consensus is met. And I guess that's really kind of the question today. How do we approach this when it's very technical topics? There's technical experts, geniuses working on this stuff, and then there's all the plebs who are running their node thinking, man, well, do I upgrade my node? You know, is this something I'm actually supportive of? And it can get very knee-jerky and kind of anecdotal, when actually maybe there's, you know, a lot more nuance to it. So what are your thoughts about that, Rob?
Yeah, it's a great point you make. I defer to a podcast I listened to with Adam Back in it, who said that he went to a conference filled with technologists and investors, and the technologists asked the investors what new features they'd like to see on Bitcoin, and that the investors, he said he was surprised by the answer, which was the investors just said, look, just don't break this, right? And so there's this trade-off of Bitcoin is super sound, super solid, it's slow moving, and that is, like, you know, a bad thing for people who want to change it, but it's a great thing for people who just want to have their sound money not messed with. And so the trouble is that as a Bitcoin community, we have to come to a consensus on what Bitcoin is. And so there's two choices. We don't ever change Bitcoin. Well, there's obviously a lot more than two choices, but there's kind of two ends of the spectrum. One is that we don't ever change Bitcoin. I'm not suggesting this. I'm just saying, and that, you know, Bitcoin maintains its sort of sound money, you know, reliability, solidness into the future, but potentially loses out to new use cases that enable more features, which give it more usability into the future. And the downside of just adding every kind of, you know, oh, let's do this, let's do that upgrade to Bitcoin is that every upgrade we add through the law of unintended consequences can have more effects on Bitcoin than we anticipate or even potentially want. So, upgrading Bitcoin is something that has to be done extremely carefully, and it has to be done with extremely large consensus, because we don't want to sort of split the community like we've seen in the past, because it's just too chaotic. And so, yeah, I don't know.
That's
the question.
Well, I guess in my time in Bitcoin, the only real major upgrades that I've seen were the Taproot upgrades, and SegWit was a bit before my time. But it seems like, I mean, that I was kind of coming in, and that just sort of happened. And I know there was a lot of work that went into that, because there was a couple of BIPs that were encapsulated in that update. At the moment, I mean, there's been chatter around some of these sort of rushed BIPs that people have come up with. And I don't know, I don't see the same degree of kind of communication going on. I guess, you know, Bitcoin Reddit, was it Bitcoin Talk? You know, there's the forums where maybe once upon a time that was the site of discussion, but I'm not fully sure. I mean, now there's the Bitcoin mailing list still, and different places where technical conversations are happening. But it's a small number of people really who are working on this stuff at the deepest level. How is that consensus met? How is it communicated? You know, where are the champions and the cheerleaders who are kind of talking about stuff and debating it? It seems like there's a few kind of people on Twitter maybe who are talking about things, but I mean, how do you get consensus in the current media environment where we've got a fracturing of channels? Yeah, I mean, that's an open question, but how do you rally people around a BIP these days?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I think we've identified that, you know, whatever change you suggest to Bitcoin, whether good or bad, you've got to expect some level of mudslinging. So you've got to be pretty thick-skinned, it seems, to sort of propose a change. I think some of the changes we've seen more recently, I think adding urgency to it when there is actually no real urgency is a massive red flag. And whether if you come to the Bitcoin community with it like a good change, but you go, we need to do this tomorrow, like that just sets off red flags for lots of people, because you know there's nothing necessarily needs to happen urgently. Bitcoin is still ticking along quite nicely. Or maybe it doesn't change as fast as you would like, but that, as I've already, you know, explained, is a feature as well as a bug. So and mainly a feature, to be fair. So I think if you wanted to propose a change to Bitcoin, you just have to be very humble and, you know, take every question as a good faith question. Try your ultimate best not to troll people. I'm not saying I'd be any good at this, but I think if you look at the way Satoshi originally sort of described Bitcoin to people who were very skeptical in the early days is a good sort of template. He was never rude to anyone. I think the rudest he got was saying to somebody, look, if you don't get this, I'm sorry, I just don't have time to explain it to you, kind of thing. So it's I think you just have to you have to explain exactly why this change is so important and what it's doing. And you've got to provide all the code. You've got to do a lot of legwork, and it's, you know, and you're potentially not getting paid for this, but then that kind of brings me to sort of some of the proposed changes where venture capital money has been involved, has sort of muddied the water a bit and in the intentions and the reasoning for this. And so, I think you've just got to be you've got to be a very polite cheerleader who's very technically competent and able to explain technical things in a way that people who aren't so technical can understand. Superhero, maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a bit of a, you know, an amazing, you know, being both humble and a genius, it's sometimes hard to come by. I'm just wondering, though, I mean, L2 really, as you say, it's part of growing Lightning and making Lightning more scalable, more robust. But my recent thoughts have been around, I mean, there has been an emphasis on Lightning, and I mean, it's really quite an amazing system. But I mean, going back and looking at things like sidechains and sort of how much they were sort of talked about, you know, a few years ago, and sort of where that is today. And I just wonder, you know, is there the possibility that this focus on Lightning, though we love it and it's so good to use, you know, longer term, is it actually the scaling solution and the layer two that Bitcoin needs, you know, for more and more people to use it? I really don't know. I really like it. It works well for me. But, you know, at what point does the paradigm change? You know, it's obviously everyone sort of agrees and it's a consensus thing, but I mean, I just look at the sidechain conversation and it's sort of gone very quiet. And I'm not talking about drive chains here, but just, you know, things like Liquid, Rootstock, which I was reading about recently, you know, I don't think there's very much usage on that. And though, it, you know, the intention of Liquid was you could have these, you know, settlement of transactions between exchanges and a lot more volume, I understand. Then you could have if you're doing it straight onto the Bitcoin blockchain. So it's like, I don't know, is Lightning even the thing that we need? And if we're building all of this stuff for Lightning on Bitcoin, being a bit of a devil's advocate, but yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Lightning's the one we have and the one that's in production and the one that's working right now. And because of that, it's easy to critique it because we know all the faults. We know where it's a bit creaky, and we, you know, and it must be incredibly difficult for the Lightning developers all coming to consensus on this protocol where there's a few different implementations and, you know, they're trying to add new features and maintain it all the time. So my hat is off to all the Lightning developers, just an incredible job that they're doing. You know, there's always that kind of grass is greener mentality where you can go, okay, what about this new thing I've just thought up where we could, you know, so, I mean, but I'm not saying that's the particular instance or situation that this is, but ARC has been suggested as a way. So there's a problem with Lightning is incoming liquidity. So if you want to receive a payment on Lightning, you need somebody to have set up a channel with balance on the other side and with them having good connectivity to the rest of the network for you to receive a payment on Lightning. So if you bootstrap like a sort of a node from scratch, and then you have it up and working. Nobody can actually pay you until you have a channel coming into you with some funds on the other side. Somebody's locked those funds up. So there's a guy called Burak, and he's described this new level layer two that we could have called ARC. And that's where you can have sort of liquidity providers, ARC liquidity providers, and then users. And then it's a sort of a mishmash of sort of Lightning and Chromium eCash, which is sort of a new kind of token that you can create. It's a mishmash of that to enable, to basically solve this problem of incoming liquidity on a layer two that Lightning currently has. But the problem with that is it's an idea that's kind of at the sort of, it's an idea at the white paper stage, but doesn't have any sort of real code or any usage behind it as such. So potentially ARC itself could have some kind of problems which Lightning doesn't, that we wouldn't know about until it was actually being used, you know, on, as a network as such. So
yeah.
And it's taken all of these years for Lightning to get to where it is, and you know, I don't know if we have that time for something else to get its act together, to get the merchant adoption, to get the apps built and that sort of thing. But coming back to Lightning, you know, I was listening to a really good chat on Stefan Lavera's podcast about Phoenix Wallet, and actually understanding the ecosystem there, because as you know, we were on that technical talk with Lisa from Base 58, and you know, hearing the work that she was doing on Lightning, and I mean that was really, you know, a really good workshop. And I actually feel that the Lightning development is happening at a much quicker pace. You know, there's a number of different implementations, you know, and they can kind of, they're kind of working pretty quickly compared to, say, what's happening on the Base chain. And not that it's bad that that's slow, but I feel they've got a lot more, they can move faster, and, you know, CLN can come up with something, and then the others adopt that, you know, and they can start working and scaffolding the protocol. And in that sense, it feels very different to the Base, like, you know, to Bitcoin, I guess. You know, like Lightning is kind of fintech, you know, and it's just those pegs where it, you know, it goes on chain, and that's the bit where it interfaces. But everything else that happens on Lightning, it kind of doesn't really matter what Bitcoin's doing, right? It's only, and sorry, that's a bit naive for me to say maybe, but like, you know, all of the LN URLs, all of the different, you know, amazing QR code stuff, that's all in Lightning world. And what we're talking about here is where those two things connect, and this very simple covenant proposal, which would enable perhaps a strengthening of that ecosystem, because it makes it a lot less risky to build stuff and to run nodes, because you're not going to risk the whole thing if you fat finger an old state. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a great way that things are organized, that we have this base layer where the development is very slow and we're stable and we know where we're at. And, you know, and the backwards compatibility means that if I'm running a Bitcoin node that's way out of date, I can still look at the network and understand what's going on to a certain degree. And I can still make transactions based on the protocol rules available to my node at that time in its software. And you're right. And then with Lightning Network, much faster. We can move, you know, we're moving quicker. We're trying things. We have some faults sometimes, but that's to be expected. And like you say, the innovation layer can kind of, yeah, it can, we've got this kind of, yeah, like you said, a lot of development going on, a lot of movement, new features. We've got people able to build and connect on top of those as well. Not necessarily layer threes as such, but sort of using Lightning as an instant payment that you can bolt into any app. And I know that Breeze SDK are doing great work in that respect. And you can get up and going with Lightning payments in an app extremely quickly now. Incoming liquidity and all using the Breeze Lightning LSP, they call it, the Lightning service provider.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, again, I'm looking at this just through my creative lens and just sort of trying to connect all the dots. But the Lightning layer, I mean, that's how I think most people engage with Bitcoin, you know, like, you know, base chain transactions are still, I mean, that's probably the bigger volume, I would imagine. And we don't know which ones necessarily are Lightning transactions, I guess. I mean, I'd imagine that the two of two multisig would have a fingerprint on chain that you could identify, do you know?
Yeah, that's right. They do, but Taproot eliminates that fingerprint. So once the Lightning nodes move over to using Taproot, you won't be able to tell whether it was a Lightning transaction or not, Lightning channel open or close or not.
But I guess the layers here, sort of the social work, okay, so in the world, getting merchants and having people using Bitcoin and the Lightning network, it seems like that work is actually more around the Lightning side, you know, like, you know, payments, retail payments, invoicing, all of that stuff. And that's actually quite a much bigger space. And even it's a paradigm shift as well, because it is final settlement though. So it's kind of Bitcoin's philosophy of decentralization. You know, there's no trusted custodian who's really keeping the database of who owes who. You know, there's none of that, but it's still so that's a paradigm shift. So it's, you know, you've got the funds come in, it's final settlement, but it's also able to move faster and do other stuff that you just couldn't do, you know, the microtransactions and all of that. So it's like, oh man, it's such a big space. And so I mean, how do you even think about this? Because rolling out a new paradigm for payments, whether people even know what Bitcoin is, if you can just say, hey, I've got this happening, I can just pay you. I mean, that's got a lot of value. And you almost don't even need to talk about Bitcoin. You know, it's just a wallet with some value. And even if the value is denominated in your local currency or something, it's not quite the same. And I don't know, it's like, how does that all fit together? Because I imagine technical people are going to be diving into the one thing that they're doing, but they may be like, how do they see the bigger picture of how this is all changing around the world?
Yeah, I imagine there is a fair amount of that. The fact that you're working your sort of nose down on some particular aspect of Bitcoin, you sort of do need to be aware of what's going on around you as well. I'm not saying that that's, you know, everybody's working with blinkers on, but yeah, it's... I think one of the concerns is at the moment is definitely scaling, and the fact that Lightning is an excellent scaling solution, given that we still sort of, it can be built on top of Bitcoin and it still obeys all the properties of Bitcoin and it is still Bitcoin, but it allows another magnitude of number of users to use it. So instead of having an on-chain wallet, you just need a UTXO. But we've identified that, unfortunately, not as Bitcoin as it currently stands, not everybody in the world can have their own UTXO just because there isn't the block space available for sort of 8 or 9 billion UTXOs, essentially. We could do it if we had sort of 10 years to confirm all the transactions, is my understanding, or something like that. But at the moment, there is more people looking into how do we keep scaling Bitcoin, or, you know, not necessarily how do we keep scaling Bitcoin, but how do we allow as many people as possible to access the benefits that Bitcoin gives in as trustless a way as possible. Yeah. Given that trustless isn't, you know, like a true or false, it's like a, you know, a zero to a sort of a, you know, it's like a spectrum, obviously.
Yeah, think about it. I mean, what role do trusted custodians have in this space? And I think that's a question that gets a lot of people's backs up, you know, when you've got, custodial Lightning, for example, or basically even just Bitcoin IOUs, which we know that it's not a good idea and that, but to expect the world to run their own node, I mean, that's also wishful thinking. And so what is the role here and how do those... You know, how do those cards come out? Is Bitcoin almost just the threat of having, you know, going on chain and having the justice transaction take place enough to keep custodians in the future, honest? If there is, and maybe this is, again, it's a painful thing to hear, but maybe that's the role of the state, you know, to come in and, you know, regulate Bitcoin custodians and say, hey, you know, you need to keep records and that sort of thing. And like, how does that play out? You know,
I think it turns the model on its head, because as we've seen recently from some thinking from some reserve banks that we know quite well, they've sort of, their thinking is of, we are the people who should be trusted, or we are the ones who you can trust, is the kind of the thinking there. Whereas Bitcoin allows you to decide who you want to trust. It's sort of, it's like a, it's almost like it opens a free market of people who you could potentially trust. And I mean, to say Bitcoin is trustless is sort of not exactly right, because we're trusting all the time. I'm trusting the wallet developer to have, you know, coded it correctly and not made a mistake. Trusting there's enough eyes on the Bitcoin software that there's not, you know, not any bugs in there. I trust, use a wallet like Wallet of Satoshi, and it's obviously a custodial wallet. And it's not that, because it's custodial, I don't trust it with very much funds, but I can choose how much I do want to trust it. And so I might chuck $200 on Wallet of Satoshi just because it's really quick and easy to use. And if they disappear with that money, you know, I'm not even going to bat an eyelid, really. I'm going to be like, oh, well, $200 gone, real shame. The bigger shame is that, you know, such a decent wallet has actually, you know, gone wrong would be my biggest upset, rather than the actual money that I'd lose there. And so I think having this free market of potential people who we can trust is a much better model than the current top down, we are in control, you must trust us kind of scenario, which isn't ideal.
Well, I think that's what I'm getting at, is that you don't actually, you have a choice. And so if you want to be fully self-custodial, that's totally fine. And, you know, everyone will harp on about that, you know. I use Wallet of Satoshi as well, and it's great, you know. And I just wonder, longer term, are we going to have, you know, the people that you trust, you know, because there's, you know, things like Fiddy and that, which, you know, you can nominate some people and say, hey, we're going to have a family Fiddy or something, you know, that's also an option. But that, it feels like quite a radical departure from just the entire world we live in at the moment. And obviously we're going through some major changes, but assuming some semblance of social structures and remain, I don't think there'll be things like banks, but, you know, will organizations, companies emerge that are custodial solutions for, you know, for large amounts of people? You know, will those things emerge? How will they gain trust? You know, because I think there is always going to be some sort of brand affinity. It's a human thing, right? You know, we identify with tribes and imagery and brands. I don't for one moment think there's a reality where every single person runs their own node and that sort of thing. It's just never going to be like that. So there's going to be these, you know, people on the fringes who are fully self-sovereign. There's going to be people who are maybe tied to different levels of custodians. And it's kind of more of it's a bit more like the internet, where you could, you know, you could use Facebook, or you could roll your own, you know, servers and do your own thing, you know, and we're all connected through this internet, but the way we interface with it now has optionality. And I mean, that, I think that's where it's not absolute. Yeah. Sorry. Going into some big ideas there, but so there'll be different solutions for different people. And Lightning, because it is final settlement though, it's like, I mean, I like it because it can be both a custodial thing for people who don't know anything, as well as a non-custodial thing for people who are onto it. And it doesn't actually require trust in the network. So even if you know, it requires you to trust the company that you're working with, but the way they're operating, you know, you could always send that money back to another self-custodial wallet and you're all good. You know what I mean? Like, that's an even playing field. And how you choose to engage with that. It's like, some days I'm going to use Gmail and other days I'm going to run my own email server, but I can still send an email between those two things. Unless Gmail blocks your server because it's marking it as spam. And that's where maybe there's some longer range challenges, right? Like blacklisting addresses, blacklisting Bitcoin, that sort of thing, which is a bit of a bigger topic, but yeah.
Yeah, it ties into that conversation you were having with the lawyer from Schwalbeck. Sorry, I forgot his name. And it's about I think that the aim of getting everybody to be in as much control of their own finances as possible is sort of like where we're aiming, but you then have to trade that off with how technically competent they are, and that's obviously where the rubber meets the road. And so like you say, it depends. Yeah, it depends what your inclination is and how much money you're storing and how much, how involved you want to be and how much you care about that particular chunk of funds. Yeah, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the game theory, and this is the stuff that really gets me excited is, you know, does Bitcoin always, you know, for the most part, continue to exist not as the primary means of transaction, but really as a kind of a, I don't know, a threat looming over any other system. And so it almost keeps some whatever future version of fiat money exists. It kind of keeps it in check. I don't know. It's almost like mutually assured destruction or something, you know, like, well, I can always just go and use Bitcoin as a backstop. Does that actually mean that other money becomes more, I don't know, you can trust it a little bit more. And there's more of a dynamic there where it's not just like fiat just dies. It's like, oh yeah, you know, we're going to use the US dollar that's going to become the global reserve currency. And if they ever do any shenanigans, they'll see it straight away because we'll be pulling out into Bitcoin. And it kind of, there's like this yin and yang, and maybe over the super long term that eventually moves into Bitcoin. But I wonder if there's this kind of like bimetallism that takes place. And so shitty fiat currencies die, but you know, we're left with a couple of the big ones. Yeah, man, I'm sorry, I'm totally speculating right
no,
now.
No, that's cool. I it's just made me think about the fact that actually one of the uses of fiat currency is control. And that's potentially, we've heard Christine Lagarde describe sort of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as an escape, to use her words, people trying to escape. And so, yeah, while you're using the dollar, you're under some level of control and surveillance, and that's the truth to it. And so I think I think central bankers and stuff should be looking at Bitcoin and going, well, we should clean our act up and start operating better. I think rather than it being a sort of an encouragement to them, it should be more of a like a, you know, here's truth, here's financial truth. We're aiming to build a system that is as true as possible, to as transparent and as, you know, as open as possible. And so the further your system gets away from this, you know, we'll be able to see that the value of Bitcoin should go up, because in my opinion, the truth is worth way more than whatever lie you're being sold. So it should be night and day and obvious to be all involved at some stage that, you know, Bitcoin is the way to do a currency, as long as you value truth and openness and all the values of Bitcoin, essentially. And then I'm not saying that fiat's going to go away overnight, but this is the people who are in control of the fiat should be looking at it like, wow, well, this is a standard that we should be adhering to, is how I'd like to imagine they look at it. But you know,
yeah, just, we're getting into some deep areas here, because like I think what you and I value is that, you know, we have certain values around freedom and truth and that sort of thing. But I mean, those aren't universal values. I think, I mean, I would like to think they're universally important, but actually for a lot of people, comfort, authority, you know, trust in an authority is actually a core value and a core part of their personality that's unchangeable. And it seems ridiculous to us, but in the same sense for those people looking at someone who says, look, give me freedom or give me death. They say, give me, you know, I want to be alive. I want to live in bondage. And I mean, we only had to look at COVID for that, you know, and so and the overwhelming majority who participated in that. So it gives me pause for thought that, you know, it's a small number of people who actually value freedom and liberty, and they sort of shine like beacons in the night. And with something like Bitcoin, it kind of, the threat of it maybe is actually enough in some cases to, you know, sort of slowly change the tide. And maybe there is this great reformation of civic structures and the return to, you know, some sort of society. Because I think the idea of like a pure anarchist kind of free market thing, I mean, that is an option, you know, that could be a possible future. But I don't know, man, like, I don't know anything. And all I want to look at is what the different options are and what the different possibilities are. And, you know, maybe there is just some neo future that, and that future looks back on the kind of the current closed government and thinks, man, it was so bad. And I'm glad we innovated and we built this new kind of open democratic system. You know, it's all out on the table. It's all on the ledger. And they, you know, they're pegged to Bitcoin or something, but there's a pride and a trust and a value placed on government and leadership and society in a way that currently isn't there, where it's, I mean, I only have contempt for the government right now.
Very deep.
We went deep, but where this all comes back to, I think, really the technical talk is there are changes being proposed. There's things talked about that would help, you know, improve Bitcoin. And what that means is kind of, I guess, a little bit what we were just talking about right at the end there, like, you know, is Lightning and all of this stuff important? Because if Bitcoin only needs to exist as a kind of a money that is on the fringes and it's an available counter, it's almost like a pre-signed unbroadcast transaction that will destroy the existing financial system, right? It's just sitting there waiting to go. It will work, and when we need it, it's always going to be there. And so that's kind of the ossification argument. Just don't touch anything. Don't do anything. It's just about, it works. You know, we don't even need Lightning. We just need the ability to transfer value. You know, that's like one hardcore argument. Then scaling that up to the entire world, and we move from, you know, database, you know, based payments and Visa cards and things to, you know, everyone having final settlement. Like, that's another conversation. And I don't know. Like, we're making changes to enable that a little, and they're only little changes, but it's kind of like the bigger vision for that. And as a decentralized project, like, you can't just stand up and say, oh, I have a vision, Cody's vision for Bitcoin. Like, I'm going to get shot down for that. You know, like, it's a discourse. And so, yeah, it's messy, man. I don't know where we go from here.
I think that is the discourse, is you stand up and say, hey, I'm Cody, here's what I want Bitcoin to be. And then obviously you duck because you get tomatoes thrown at you. And then somebody else goes, well, Cody, I think Bitcoin should be this. And, you know, and then I get tomatoes thrown at me. But I think that's how you get consensus, by hearing some, I mean, as long as you're looking for truth, you hear the most reasonable argument. And unless you're holding some kind of emotional reason for whatever it is, you go, okay, this does make a lot of sense. And you got to admit, doesn't matter what prior stance you had, that you were, you know, you've got to admit that you were wrong. And that's the hardest thing, but it's the best way of upgrading yourself, is admitting what you've done wrong. I'm in favor of very cautiously upgrading Bitcoin when we've seen a clear benefit and use case and need for what the upgrade is.
Maybe my homework then is, because, you know, Covenants here, you know, L2 is an idea, but Covenants, whether it's APO or CTV, is the way that we get to that. And there's other pieces, you know, multi-channel payments. Sorry, multi-user channels. Is that right for yep. Lightning? So you can have more going on there with channel openings. There's some stuff there. The Covenants itself, there's also, I mean, L2 is one use case for that. There's also the vaults and different kinds of uses there. Maybe my homework is actually to look into a bit more, who are the people who are proposing these things, where, how far along are they? What are the differences between the different proposals? Because, I mean, it's not like every BIP that comes along is going to get put into Bitcoin. If this was the next thing that we did, and Bitcoin, you know, adopts some covenant proposal that enables all of that, you know, are we good to go for the next, you know, decade? Is that almost just one of the last things, you know, and what are the last few things? Because I know there is the 64-bit overflow issue in about 100 years or something you might be familiar with. Do you know the one?
There's some number is going to overflow and causes a problem.
Yeah, the timestamp, I think it is.
You're right. We've got 60 to 100 years to fix our thing.
So we've got that one that needs to be sorted. And then, maybe L2 and like, what are the other two things that we need to build a vision, and whose vision is that, you know, a lightning for everyone, Bitcoin for everyone, like what's required there, what are the current limitations? And looking at it, you know, billions of people using this network every day, like what other stuff is required on the base chain? Because Lightning will just continue doing, you know, getting innovated on every day. But on the base layer, on the settlement layer, what is actually needed? And then mapping that out. I mean, succinctly mapping that out would be really interesting. You know, what's not needed? You know, side chains, you know, is that relevant to the conversation? Like,
yeah, I mean, given that like Liquid is already a side chain that's running, so any other side chain wanted to do the thing, they could just do it in the same way that Liquid did. So like, go ahead kind of thing. I've heard other people say that, look, we've already got Taproot assets. You want an asset that isn't Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network, you can use Taro, which is part of the Taproot upgrade. You could do that right now. So maybe we haven't explored Taproot assets enough, and so maybe the innovation can happen there. And at the point at which you do that innovation, to the point at which you're in a roadblock that prevents, and it's been proven useful, and loads of people are using it. You say, well, we could improve. I think efficiency improvements are the easiest things to argue for, and that's what things like SegWit was. Just the fact, if you can reduce the amount of on-chain footprint, you can then just do more stuff. And if it's already working, and that's your improvement, I think those are often quite an easy one to argue for. Well, not easy necessarily, but ones that you can potentially get over the line.
Yeah. So it's a bit of Bitcoin futurism. And again, I appreciate you putting up with my technical incompetence, but I think I can feel that there is bigger conversations around where these things are going, and obviously efficiency is one layer, but you know, more broadly, Lightning being you know, being core infrastructure, you know, and that's a good argument here. You know, like it's really easy to fat finger, the hardware goes down and Lightning stops working. Like, okay, there's not enough resilience there for Lightning to scale to the world. You know, what if you know, a country or, you know, a big organization's Lightning node goes offline and they lose those funds. It's like, from a risk perspective, they're never going to work on that. And so that's actually going to hold adoption back. And what are your metrics for how you measure this stuff? Because anything that enables more broader decentralization and adoption, you know, without breaking core mechanisms would be valuable. And so, you know, then there's a conversation around the technical issues and making sure there's no bugs. But like, From that perspective, you know, I'm really keen. Maybe I can track some of these people down and get them on the show and let's talk about covenants and let's talk about what the proposals are and where to from here. I think there's places where these conversations can happen. I think podcasts are a good one. I think written white papers and things as well are important. But facilitating conversations and getting out of the way, getting the ego out of the way, and just sort of saying, well, I don't know, but can you explain it to me and we can talk through it and try and find truth together.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'd like to say thank you for putting up with my technical incompetence, because next to some of these developers, honestly, don't feel pretty inferior. But we're all where we're at, right? And we all have a level of understanding and a resolution. You know, the guys working on it obviously have the highest resolution, but we have to work on these low resolution sort of ideas of what we expect this is and how it can help and what it does. So, yeah, no, it's definitely, I think it'd be great if you were able to get some of the developers and proponents of these things on the podcast. I'd find that very interesting.
I might see what I can do, because I mean, I need to study it a bit more, but you've given me some really good direction here, and I really enjoy what you've written here, and you've provided these notes here which kind of articulate how it all works together and sort of why this covenant upgrade would be so important to enabling L2, which then enables all this other stuff we've talked about, and then how that sort of manifests in reality is an emergent phenomenon, you know, how the world adopts Bitcoin. But having more resilience to Lightning and being able to build with more confidence and operate Lightning with more confidence, I can see that only as a good thing. And also Bitcoin itself on the base layer, having more confidence around something like the vaults, and that, I mean, maybe that's just the thing that we need for large institutions to be like, yeah, okay, we can now guarantee that it's kind of okay to put $1 billion in this thing, and if we fat finger it, we've got, you know, 2 weeks to you know, to fix the transaction, which we saw. What was that thing the other week with the Paxos or some they paid the mining fee, like 19 bitcoins.
An incorrect fee on the transaction.
So that guy fat fingered, like someone's sitting there, he's like, all right, we're gonna put
poor developer.
Yeah, man. Having a late night, he pushed it to production and it sent 19 Bitcoin in the mining fee. So look, then mistakes happen, you know, and I think that's maybe that's the angle here. It's like, it's just that little bit, that one more safety net or the kind of, you know, there's that one rope now that's kind of, you're not just free climbing the mountain, you've got the rope and you shouldn't use it. You shouldn't have to use it. But if you ever do need to use it, you're going to be good. And that's going to mean that you have the confidence now to climb the mountain. As a very simple way of looking at it maybe, but
yeah.
That's what I'd like to find out. So yeah, I'll try my best to try and talk to these people, and then you know, and we've done well to communicate today. I think you've done, thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks. Yeah.
But yeah, we might wrap it there, Rob.
Thanks for the conversation. Go on, Ian. I've enjoyed it.
No, all good, mate. Right, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.